When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, bud, listen, I'm going to be gone for like 4 months and going camping. Would you be willing to watch the studio for me while I'm gone?
You're going homeless training for 4 months?
Yeah. It's not going to feel like it's that long. Listen, the last guy who watched the studio, though, he went a little nuts and like killed a bunch of people. But you'll probably be fine. Are we good?
Yeah, I guess so.
Awesome. You're the man.
Wait a second. You killed somebody? What?
Come podcast with us, Vader.
Come podcast with us, Vader.
Nope.
Wonder what Vader's been tweeting.
Do you like what you see? Oh no! I forgot my keys! Damn it! I forgot my keys! Where are my keys?
Man, that camping trip was awesome. Nobody went insane while I was gone, right? Holy sh! Is Vader dead?
Yeah, I guess he watched The Last Jedi one too many times.
That'll do it. Welcome back to another episode of the Salty Nerd Podcast. This week, for Spooky Month, we are talking about Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, The Shining.
How dare you?
I'm going to get you on this one.
This guy's Stephen over here going to be over here.
Masterpiece?
Red Rab.
Yes.
This is the greatest movie ever made.
Ooh, we're going to have some hot takes for you this week. Welcome, guys. We're talking The Shining. I'm joined, as always, by my fantastic, salty panel of nerds. Matt Vader's here. Salty as ever. What's up, dude?
This movie was so fucking long.
It's way too long.
Too long.
Fist bump. You and I are going to be on team A over here. Team Salty.
It's kind of
the table is split already.
Yeah.
Get ready for this discussion. Judah's also here. What's up?
Hello.
Oh, my God. Here we go.
She's going to do the whole synopsis like that.
she threatened me.
I did.
She was like, I'm going to do the synopsis like this.
And I'm like, that's fine. That's what half the movie is.
Please, God.
Half the movie is Tony talking.
What's his mom's name?
Mrs.
Wendy.
What's her last name?
Torrance.
I don't know, Mrs. Torrance.
Shut the fuck up, kid. No wonder fucking Jack Nicholson went nuts in this
you
show.
You would give your kid away.
Listen.
Child.
Oh, that little fucker.
If I had to wake up in bed every morning with that face staring back at me, I would go crazy.
With
too.
Olive oil?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Fuck, put a bag on your head.
The film nerd Matthew Cages is also here producing the show. What's up?
So this is the first time on the Salty Nerd podcast that we've gotten to talk about a Kubrick film.
Didn't we talk about Full Metal Jacket?
Instantly, mm-hmm. You two are poo-pooing on it. So we talked about Full Metal Jacket in the sense that we were interviewing Adam Baldwin at the time.
We never reviewed that movie. Yeah. Okay.
So this is the first time we've actually gotten to sit down, watch an entire Stanley Kubrick film and get to discuss it.
Okay.
And I'm already disappointed.
Listen. You're not going to get an hour and a half to get all fucking movie student.
You don't want to go down the rabbit hole?
I got things to say.
Yeah, man. Movie. Come on, dude. Let's talk about the moon landing for a couple minutes.
I'm going to address that, too. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, my favorite part of the movie was every time the kid would get scared and he'd have that dumb look on his face. And the first time he did it, I literally laughed out loud. I laughed out loud.
Come play with us, Danny.
It's like, I've literally never been more disappointed in a horror movie in my life. Except for maybe Exorcist.
Yeah, that's up there.
It was right there.
Let's get into it. Jude.
Yes.
Continue.
Or begin.
Whatever.
1980, The Shining, rated R with a runtime of 2 hours 26 minutes.
Blah.
This had a budget of $19 million. What do you think this brought into the box?
That's not bad. $19 million. That's pretty cheap. Box office, I don't know what Kubrick films brought in. I have no idea. I'm going to say $62
million. All right.
I'm guessing. I have no idea.
What's your call?
I wouldn't even know where to begin.
I know, right? It's hard to say because, like, Kubrick's like a weird cult.
I mean,
say a number.
This definitely has some societal impact.
Sure.
It's a cult movie. It's a very famous movie. I can't deny that. I don't know why, but I can't deny it. initial release or overall?
Worldwide.
Overall?
Box office.
Theatrical run.
Or for the 12 weeks it was out in the theater.
Not including streaming numbers, I don't think.
Yeah. I don't know.
Theatrical release.
Yeah.
$42
million. Okay. Had a budget of $19 million with a box office bring home of $47 million. Speedboat.
Nice.
Keep in mind that 1980, $19 million was an expensive movie.
Yeah.
Sure.
They had to rent out that whole hotel.
All right. Go ahead.
The Overlook Hotel, a fine family establishment, except for all the murders. Jack Torrance and his family are tasked with taking care of the snowed-in resort for the winter. While Jack works on his great American novel, All Work and No Play, Wendy takes on the job Jack was hired for and waits for permission to make noise and save her kid from the psycho in room 237. Thank God Tony's there to look out for Danny. He tries to warn Wendy about the red rum about to happen, but that weak bitch had her heart set on getting her brains bashed the fuck in and can't be bothered with having a backbone right now. Meanwhile, Jack's in the bar getting advice from the last caretaker on how to manage that work bitch wife balance. Discuss.
I understand that this movie is extremely popular. It's got some cultural significance behind. Stop it. You're going to fuck with me. You're making me laugh. It's been broken down frame by frame. I've watched like 3 hour long documentary. Would you guys stop? I've watched documentaries on this thing.
Our Tonys are trying to make out.
All right.
No, go ahead. No, you were heading in the right place.
I get it, man. I get it. But God, this is not my movie. I dislike this movie.
Really?
As a movie watcher, I find it dull, stupid, annoying, and unscary.
Pretentious.
It's very like, ooh, Kubrick frame. All the logos are facing the frame, and this chair is a little bit crooked. Who fucking cares? Oh, the TV doesn't have a cable on it.
But
what does that symbolize? It means the fucking designer of the set sucked. I don't know. What do you want me to say? It's a fucking boring horror movie.
It's not even
but
scary.
But it's probably super subliminal. Kubrick probably was trying to tell us something about the moon landing. I kind of believe that at this point. I'm like, you know what? You're probably right. I'm gonna. I like that documentary where they explain all that.
Like room 237 is 237,000 miles away.
But here's the thing.
And the kid with the sweatshirt and he stands up and it looks just like the launching pad. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da.
Yeah, probably. It's a shitty movie.
If you have to watch a documentary about a movie to appreciate a movie, the movie's probably not that good.
Probably not that good.
Right?
Yeah. I feel like the movie is secondary.
Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest. What about that? I don't have to watch
that documentary is dope.
Oh, it's amazing.
And you want to watch it.
But the movie
is good by itself.
Yeah.
The movie. No.
You know what I really enjoyed?
What you really enjoyed?
All the really cool camera angles from behind people when they were walking through the line.
Listen, Kubrick has his style. And I like it. He's got the Kubrick stare. You got the Jack Nicholson. Nicholson was the shit in this movie. I'll give him that.
He's so good in this movie.
Yeah.
Couldn't you tell from the very first frame Jack was in that he was a crazy person?
Well, Jack Nicholson is just. He just already leans that way in all of his movies.
Even if you had never seen this movie before.
He's totally going to kill his family.
You know he's a psychopath.
Yeah.
Just because of the way he talks.
If you want a crazy person for your movie.
Jack Nicholson is the way to go.
You hire Jack Nicholson.
And if you can't hire Jack Nicholson, you get Christian Slater.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because he's basically like the sequel to Jack Nicholson.
OG in the sequel.
I'm looking at his face over here.
He's so disappointed in us.
He hates us right now.
Yeah, I know. It's okay. It's all right. Listen, I appreciate this movie. I understand people like love it, and film critics like this guy and film nerds like just dive into it neck deep and just masturbate to it.
There are people who watch this movie at 25% speed, frame by frame, to analyze it.
Well, they're weird.
Hard pass. It takes
all day.
It's just not for me, man. It's just not for me. I don't like it. I like Full Metal Jacket. That's a fucking good movie.
Yeah.
I'm not saying Kubrick's a bad director.
Kubrick's a good filmmaker.
Kubrick's a very good filmmaker. This is very subliminal, very interesting, very unique. I appreciate Kubrick. This is not my movie. I have no love for this movie, except for Jack Nicholson's performance. That's the only thing that I'm really like, God damn it. When he's in a room by himself, just acting like a lunatic, he's freaking good.
This is my
what the fuck you hear me doing in here?
My favorite scene in this movie is him at the bar talking to what's the bartender's name again?
Lloyd?
Talking to Lloyd.
Yeah.
When he's just one actor on another sipping on a bourbon. Like that is the best scene in the whole movie because Jack Nicholson just fucking nails it.
That scene made me thirsty.
Right?
Like sitting at 10 o'clock last night. And, I'm like, oh man, he's drinking bourbon with ice. But it looks really good.
but that scene where he's like talking about the incident with his kid, when he's like,
"That little fucker had thrown all my papers all over the floor. All I try to do is pull them up."
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
A momentary loss of muscular coordination.
He knocked my shit all on the ground.
The little brat.
The little fucking brat. And I love the kid, but I grabbed him and it was just a miscalculation. What?
Yeah.
It was like just a miscalculation on the what he said, something like muscular, you know, like power, whatever. He said some weird word like that, but like Jack Nicholson is the only part of this movie that I'm like, that's good. The rest of it.
If you listen to Olive Oil, explain what
you
happened.
You know what's hilarious is that Alex said she looks like Olive Oil.
Well, she is Olive Oil.
I didn't know that when I said that.
She's in the movie.
Yeah, I have no idea.
It's perfect. Perfectly cast. She was born to play that role.
We were like, she is Olive Oil. And he just looked at us.
And She explains to the therapist, which was a hilarious scene.
Oh, God. Yeah.
At the beginning, why?
She's smoking her cigarette.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. He just casually broke his arm.
You know,
the kind of thing that you would do 100 times.
And she's right, though. She's 100% correct. I couldn't tell you how many times my mom or my dad, when I was a little kid,
would just yank me.
Come over here.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I'm going to pull my arm out of my socket. But that never happened. But I can see how that could happen on accident.
Well, a lot of shitty parents can justify a lot of shitty things.
Right.
You know? It's like, but I got my ass beat. I got spankings.
Yeah.
You know? It's just,
listen, man, my kid was running out into the...
In 1980...
Oh, things were different.
You could spank your kid.
Dude, her kid was
it's okay.
at the kitchen table, right? And this is an 80s thing, 70s thing, whatever you want to call it. But like at the kitchen table, the kid's eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and she's got their cigarette just sitting there.
Dude's
like, can she knock the ash off her cigarette, please? Because it was like 4 inches long.
Oh, just hanging there.
Oh, but wait a second. It's a Kubrick movie. So the length of the ashes probably had some kind of weird subliminal message.
That also had to do with the moon landing.
About the fucking moon landing or some stupid shit. Yeah.
My favorite one is when they were looking at the documentary and they were looking at the pantry and they're like, if you notice, some of the logos are facing 25% a different direction than the rest of them. And this represents, I'm like, no, the fucking person in charge of the set was like,
You know what I thought? cigarettes and peanut butter. That's a great mix right there. Marlboros and peanut butter and jelly. I want a fucking cigarette. Let's go.
It tastes like 1979.
Yeah. That's exactly it.
If 1979 had a flavor, it would be peanut butter
and Marlboros.
We were talking about their house, and June and I were both like, I can totally smell this house right now. Like, 100%.
Yeah.
You know exactly what that house smells like.
It's your weird aunt's house.
It smells like a window has never been opened.
Old wood paneling and cigarette smell.
Yes. Carpeting.
Deep carpeting.
Yeah.
That's never been vacuumed.
Yeah.
And bourbon.
Marlboro's bourbon and peanut butter. Uh-huh. That's the 70s right there. Jack Daniels and fucking Marlboro's.
Jude, tell me why you love this movie.
A plastic covering over the...
Over the couch.
Over the couch.
100%.
Yeah.
All right, Jude, go ahead.
That's totally your weird aunt's house. I had that weird aunt.
Yeah, it's got those blankets all over the place, too.
Over every couch, chair. That's it.
So mean.
It's your future, Matt. You're going to be in the weird aunt's house when you grow up.
I'm already there.
Oh, yeah, there's a sweater in every room. I'm freezing all the time.
Jude's going to be the weird aunt with the cigarette and the barrel of bourbon over here. It's like, let me tell you something, darling. When I was younger, we used to talk about these movies at the studio.
When I was younger, I was a slut.
I did some things I could tell you about.
But now I'm old and I'm going to die anyway. And I thought, fuck it, I'm going to start smoking.
Then we're going to fast forward to 80s. Just let me tell you, when I was a young person,
okay,
I did a lot of weird things.
I almost forgot. We have to do this before we move on to the second half of the table. Criticless.
Oh.
We are teaming up with a new app called Criticless. Obviously, Vader and I are going to dump some salt on this movie in the Criticless app.
Don't do it.
And you guys are, I'm going to leave it up to you, find people out there who are fans of this movie to balance out our score.
I'm taking you off my friends with
benefits. No, the four of us are not friends with benefits on this app, which is the thing where if you trust a reviewer, if you line up with their personality for movies and stuff like that, you can include them on your profile as a friends with benefit. That way, when they review a movie, you can be like, oh, they like this movie. I'll probably like it, too. It's a really cool app. It gamifies how you review movies with like cool little sliders. And it has ways that you can kind of say, oh, is this movie violent? Well, yeah, it's The Shining. There's some blood and guts. And there's an elevator that opens. And there's a bunch of cranberry sauce that comes out. And then, you know, is it political? Nah, maybe. I mean, it depends on who you ask. If it's hyper-political, possibly, this movie, who knows? And it's a really cool way to review movies. Highly suggest go check it out. You can do it on desktop at criticless.com or go to your Apple or Android device and download the app Criticless. Really, really good. And it's a free speech positive platform, so you're not going to get canceled or denied access to anything. And it's kind of an answer to the Rotten Tomatoes. Why are you doing the Red Rum thing right now, man? Trying to do a pitch for our sponsor.
I'm just mocking you.
Anyway, it's a response to the nonsense that's going on with Rotten Tomatoes and other movie review sites that are just completely nonsense. You get the critic score, which is not representative at all of the general audience.
and you're distracting me again. Anyway, go to Critiqulous, guys. It's a really great app. Okay, so the second half of this table, you guys are going to gush on this movie. I'm going to start with...
You skipping me?
You and I just went back and forth for 17 minutes. You want to keep going?
No, whatever.
Okay.
I'll pine in. That's fine.
Jude.
Yes.
What's your take on this movie?
I love this movie. I'm actually really surprised that you dislike it as much as you do, because you seem like you were having a good time when we were watching it.
I can enjoy a movie, but I'm just like, I get it. I understand what this movie is to the culture. Mm-hmm. I don't ever want to watch it. It's always like when I watch this movie, it's always because, I have to watch The Shining.
I feel like it's one of those movies that when it came out, there wasn't anything else like it. And it was so scary for the time. And that's just sort of the image that you have in your head. Like, we watched The Exorcist the other day and I was like, huh, that's not scary at all.
Yeah.
No.
And I think the same thing happens with this, because like this movie's
40 something years
old.
Yeah,
it's really, it's an old movie. So when it came out, it was really horrifying and scary and creepy and unlike anything else.
It's unnerving. I'll give it that.
Yeah. And I think that like the unnervingness of it still holds up.
Sure.
But it being the scariest thing, or even the weirdest thing, is not necessarily true anymore, but it still holds a place in the history of movies for being something that is really special.
Mm. What do you think of it though?
I like it. I like it. I love the characters. I love like yelling at Wendy the entire
she was
time.
So infuriating.
And I know I downloaded the audiobook, so I'm going to listen to that this week.
The Stephen King book.
Yeah.
Which is very different
apparently
from this movie.
Apparently, it's very different. Yeah. Especially the character of Wendy is a lot stronger in the book than she is in the movie. But my only experience with this is of the movie. So that's just what I'm going to base this on. Danny is a fucking weirdo kid. I love him.
Weirdo kid.
Love him. Love Tony. The boy that lives in my mouth. That's a weird fucking way to say that, dude, kid.
When you wake up and your son is holding a 12-inch knife and going rad, 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 rad. Like, hey, maybe being secluded on some hotel in the middle of nowhere. Probably not a good idea.
Yeah. I absolutely adore I'm obsessed with the transition of Jack's character from this. I mean, he's not, I think when this movie came out, I think he was supposed to be portraying like a family man trying to be a family man, but like, 1,000 years later, we're all like, oh yeah, that's a bad dude.
There's a lot of red
flags
there.
Yeah, a lot of red flags. This is not a good dude.
Yeah.
And the progression of his insanity and his unraveling. And then when she goes and she starts like reading his manuscript and you see for how long this has actually been going on. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just so good. The way that his character, like when he's walking down the hallway and he's just like fucking freaking out walking down the hallway.
Pissed.
Oh, it's so good. You feel you feel the energy.
That's all Jack Nicholson
shifting
though.
In him.
Yeah. I credit Jack Nicholson with that, not necessarily like Kubrick's genius directing.
I think the performances in this movie were fine.
Yeah.
They were just the overall way it was portrayed. It's just weird. You know, my favorite scene in the movie is when he's in there working in the giant room with the echo and his wife comes in.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's all, in the end,
he's trying to be polite.
They start having just like a normal conversation, but by the end, he's completely unhinged and on the rails. It's like, if you hear me typing, stay the fuck out. You know, basically is where it was.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I'm like, oh.
Dude, that was really good. I turned to you and I said, every single writer who's ever been interrupted thinks that in their head when Jack Nicholson verbalized.
And I was like, yeah, I've been Wendy in this situation. Uh-huh. Like, hi, hon. How you doing? Just checking in. How's
every
your day
time
going?
You interrupt me, I have to fucking start from scratch.
Yeah.
He's just losing it.
Yeah.
I personally think that's the best scene in the whole movie.
Okay. Fair enough.
I love that scene.
You know what I mean?
And you know, so like they shot this movie in L Street Studios in London. And they basically built these sets. Mm-hmm. And that set where Jack Nicholson is like, you know, typing and stuff like that. After they were done with it, they converted it to the tomb from Indiana Jones, where him and Marion are trapped in.
No way.
Yeah. So
really?
Like that's the exact same set.
That's neat. I like that.
Where they find the Ark?
Is it the snake pit?
The snake pit?
It's the snake pit.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice.
Gotcha. I didn't know that. Cool. That's pretty interesting.
That would take a large
That's
large
a good fact.
Studio.
That's a good fact.
Yeah, not a lot of people know this, but like every single interior for like the hotel is actually like a set. Like they didn't find a hotel with these things and like shoot there. Like they built these things.
Every room in this hotel is gorgeous and grand and of a period. And you, I want to, Great Gatsby kind of thing. I want to go there. The carpeting in every room is absurd, it's gross. Dude, and I love it.
So many phallic symbols everywhere.
Yeah, right? It's all about the moon landing.
There's penis symbols everywhere.
I bet you every ski resort in the world hates this movie.
Why?
Because it's just that building is like every ski resort ever made. Just like this giant hotel.
Yeah.
At the bottom of this snowy mountain. And you know, who wants to go sleep there? Not me.
The absurdity of him being like, well, you know, financially it just doesn't make any sense to keep us open all winter long. I'm like, do you know what you could charge for freaking ski tickets?
Yeah, you are nuts, sir.
You are a bad businessman.
Yeah. Right. But there was no ski lifts or nothing. So
they put him in.
Stephen King was doing a lot of coke when he wrote that.
It's an investment. It's an investment.
As far as Stephen King goes, was this one of his earlier books or what?
It was his third book.
His third.
Third.
Yeah.
So he probably wasn't this completely movie. Carrie was his first book, and that had just gotten turned into a movie before Stanley Kubrick optioned the third book. And the third book wasn't even published when Kubrick first got it to read it. So,
All right.
And I also love, I guess love is the wrong word for this, but like I find so interesting like the behind the scenes stuff about like how tortured the actors were on the set of this in order to like get that good performance. Whatever. Like the things that Kubrick did to his actors, unfucking hinged. I would have quit 1,000 times. I would have quit at take 25. And he made these actors go like 1 in 200 takes.
Crazy.
Yeah, that's insane.
And I was like, you know, he used the third take in every single one of these fucking.
Chat says, I feel bad. The chat says you and me would probably like the crappy remake.
I doubt it.
Oh yeah, the one Stephen King directed for TV. Yeah.
Just cocaine filled TV show.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna give the floor to Kadish. Argue your point, sir.
So, this is one of the most iconic horror movies ever made in cinema, right? And the great thing about Kubrick is that Kubrick, like he's one of those filmmakers who elevates cinema from mere entertainment into art. And that's always been his MO. Like every single movie Kubrick has ever made is a piece of art. And people can go back and study his films because he was very meticulous. Everything that was on screen in a Kubrick film, he meant to have on screen. So he's the truest definition of what an auteur is. But he also understood the language of cinema. He pioneered a bunch of like cinematic techniques. But most importantly, he was a very well-respected filmmaker who actually did genre movies during the course of his career. And most people in this time frame, the 70s and 80s and stuff like that, or early 80s, I should say, if you were a quote-unquote serious filmmaker, you didn't do science fiction. You didn't do horror because that was for the schlocks. That was for the people who, you know, didn't have the talent to do like the true dramas and the true like acting pieces and stuff like that. And yet you have Kubrick, who did 2001: A Space Odyssey, which was the first and only truly serious science fiction epic to ever be put on film. And then you have him doing a horror movie. And it's fascinating to go back and watch this thing, because I've seen this movie numerous times, especially like when I was in film school. But when you really start breaking down this movie, there's so much symbolism and there's so much Easter eggs and stuff like that, where like every time you watch it, you can spot something different. And then once you spot these things, you can go to other people who are as nerdy as you and have discussions about what they mean. I'll just give you an example of this. So throughout this whole movie, there's this motif of the number 42, right? And basically, it appears throughout the course of the movie. The very opening of the movie, when we first see like that helicopter shot coming up on the Overlook Hotel, if you count the number of cars in the parking lot, there's exactly 42 cars, right? If you take room 237, 237, multiply each number, 2 times 3, then that number times 7, 42. Danny is wearing a shirt that says 42 on it when he's brushing his teeth at the beginning. And when Scatman Crothers is watching TV, there's a newscast about a $42 million spending bill. So like this number is peppered throughout this movie, and film nerds have been obsessing over like, what does it mean? What does it mean? But what's interesting about it is like, so Kubrick, he sets up the Overlook Hotel as its own character. And in a way, he meant for it to represent the United States. Like the Overlook Hotel is a representation of America and the slaughter or genocide of the Native Americans. So they talk about how the settlers in that area of Colorado like wiped out like Native Americans. The hotel's built on Native American Indian like burial ground. And that's kind of like how like a lot of the supernatural stuff happens. But the idea here is that there was a genocide of Native Americans by America, right? Symbolically. And when it comes to 42, if you break it down, 1942 was the year the Nazis came up with the final solution for the Holocaust. So like what he's doing is he's mirroring throughout by repeating this number, the idea that there was a Holocaust that happened here in America, and this is the, these are the ghosts that haunt us to this day.
Sure.
And so like it, you know, when you start breaking down his symbolism and stuff like that, there's a lot of Native American imagery in the movie. He sets this up in the story early on about, you know, being, you know, on an Indian burial ground and stuff like that. And so it's very interesting because ultimately the movie is about, you know, a Holocaust, a genocide of the family unit, stuff like that. So Kubrick as an artist just is able to layer these things in so deep into his movies. But I'll give you another example. And one of the, and this comes from Steven Spielberg, because Steven Spielberg was the first to notice this as well. Back when Spielberg directed Jaws, you know, there's that scene where Richard Dreyfuss is underwater and the severed head comes out and scares everyone.
Yeah.
And Spielberg always regretted doing that scare because he's like, when you're directing a horror movie, you get one scare, right? And once that scare happens, everyone's on guard. They're expecting the next scare. And so the next time you try to scare the audience, it's never as effective as that first jump scare. And what he noticed when watching The Shining and studying the movie as a director was that there's a scene where Wendy finds the book, right? Where it's like all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Yeah.
And what a normal director would have done is as she's flipping through the pages and she's getting more and more terrified at what she's seeing, Jack would just suddenly appear behind her and is like what you see. And then she'd be like, ah, and the audience would be like, ah.
Yeah.
But what Kubrick does instead is he cuts back to a long shot of Wendy and we see Jack coming up behind her and we see him watching her before he even says anything. And by doing that, instead of going for the jump scare, what Kubrick does is he starts creating this feeling of tension that carries all throughout the third act up until the point where Scatman Crothers appears. And in the book, right, that character actually ends up saving Danny and Wendy. So he doesn't die in the book. And so book fans were expecting, you know, this storyline that had been set up, you know, throughout the course of the movie to play out like it did in the book. But then Kubrick has Jack jump out of nowhere and instantly murder the guy. And so not only was it a surprise for the book readers, but it was also the one big scary scene. But it came at the end of this big, long tension buildup. And basically Spielberg was like, under any other director, they would never have done it that way. And because Kubrick did it that way, like he was able to keep people on the edge of their seats throughout the entire third act of this movie, leading up to like the big climax. And it was just like masterful in terms of like how a director handles things.
Huh.
Now there are two more things I want to touch on before I see the floor.
Hey, it's your floor. Keep going, man. Keep going.
So the first one is about like the number of takes that Kubrick was famous for. So like Kubrick was, you know, very meticulous about how he shot things. Like he basically said that, you know, we spend years in pre-production setting stuff up, getting ready to shoot. Why should I rush through the shooting phase? Like he was notorious for doing multiple takes. That scene where the ball rolls up to Danny as he's playing, that happened on the 50th take of that scene. They finally got it right on the 50th take. I believe that this movie is in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most takes ever done on the scene, which was like 127, something like that.
Bad director.
That doesn't mean you're a bad director, because here's the thing. This is why Kubrick did this, right? And Shelley Duvall actually talks about this in one of those documentaries where they asked her, you know, we heard that you did like over 100 takes of this one scene. Like, what's it like doing that? Like, how do you keep it fresh? Like, at any point, you know, like, do you just, you know, don't know what to do with yourself.
He has to destroy her in order to rebuild her in his image.
Well, no. Well, there was a different reason he did that, because he treated Shelley Duvall particularly bad during the course of this movie, but there was a reason for that. But what Kubrick does is basically like he might get a great take on take like 5 or 6, right? But he'll keep going, and he'll go to the point where like all the energy and spontaneity and freshness of the takes are sucked out, right? And the actors are just like tired and they're bored and they don't know what to do. But he keeps pushing them. And Shelley Duvall talked about how at a certain point you get past that hump and you've internalized what's happening in the scene to the point where like you can just do it on autopilot. You don't have to think about it.
What is it like doing a take that many times? I mean, is it possible to just to keep going and produce a kind of freshness at the end?
Yes, it is. It's funny. It's something that I discovered during the making of The Shining, was that I had never done more than, say, 15 takes before in my life. So it was a great change for me to do so many. But then after you do a certain number, it sort of goes dead. And then 5 more takes or so, and it revives itself. And by then you know the scene like the back of your hand, and you can make no mistakes with it. And you forget all reality other than what you're doing. And it's like a miracle. It comes out better than it did before.
And when that happens, actors are actually living in the moment, and they're not reading lines, they're actually like living it. And that's what Kubrick always strove to achieve with his actors, was he wanted to get them to the point where they weren't doing a performance, they were actually doing what the character was meant to be doing. And that's one of the reasons why he like would push these takes. And obviously like going over 100 takes, it's a little bit extreme, but that's the type of filmmaker Kubrick was. He was very deliberate. Nothing that's on the frame of the screen is not meant to be there. Like, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but when Jack goes in the beginning for his job interview, mm-hmm. he's wearing a green tie. But if you zoom in on that tie has the hedge maze symbols on it. Like it's designed like a hedge maze. And that's symbolizing, like, you know, the hedge maze, the thing that where the place where he dies is literally choking him. Mm. It's around his neck. Like, that's how deliberate Kubrick was, where he had planned, like, he knew Jack was going to die in the hedge maze. Well, and so, like, he put the hedge maze literally on Jack's neck in the very first scene that you see him.
Well, yeah, he wrote the fucking screenplay. Like, yeah, that of course he knows where he's going to die. It's not like, oh, it just magically happened. Like,
no, but
hey, we're going to put this tie
around
your neck.
But he's showing it to the audience.
But, yeah, I get it. It's foreshadowing. Everybody does that.
No, but it's not just foreshadowing, though. Like, it's so subtle that, like, unless you really try to look for it,
I've never noticed
that. You don't see it, yeah. So there's a lot of stuff like that in Kubrick films where he just layers in these very tiny, very small details, but they mean something. And the next thing I want to talk about is the detail of the Apollo 11 shirt that Danny was wearing.
And now you're talking my language.
Yeah.
Now you're talking my language.
Because I'm going to go through a theory here. And this is a theory I actually...
were trying to get Alex to order it, but it wouldn't have been here until tomorrow.
Yeah, I was going to wear one because they have them on Amazon for like $20. Yeah. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, I'll wear that.
So there's a big rumor out there that Stanley Kubrick filmed footage of a faked moon landing.
Right.
And a lot of people kind of dismiss this as a conspiracy theory, but there are a lot of people who believe in it, like our friend Conspiracy Tom.
That's 100% true. Yeah.
But and it is 100% true, and I'm going to tell you how it came about, because I really do believe it.
I'm sitting at a table with a bunch of moon landing deniers?
No. It's not a denial.
If that's the case, I'm fucking out.
It's not a denial.
I'm not friends with you guys at all.
Yeah, let me explain what happened, right? So a year or two before the moon landing happened, 2001 Space Odyssey was released. And this is a situation where a very well-respected filmmaker made the first believable like scene on the moon, right? Because there's a scene on the moon where they find the obelisk and it fucks a bunch of people up in that movie. Mm-hmm. But it was the first time that a serious filmmaker actually made a representation of outer space and being on the moon look realistic. Because everything before that was kind of schlocky, like, mm-hmm. like 1950s. Kind of like B movies.
What was that? Was something Robinson on Mars or whatever? Remember that?
Oh,
movie?
Oh yeah,
that we
Robinson
watched?
Crusoe on Mars.
Yeah. That's what everybody thought space movies were going to be like, mm-hmm. until Kubrick came around.
Yeah, and so what happened was NASA and the U.S. government, when they were planning the moon landing, they were like, "What happens if our cameras go down, or if the broadcast doesn't make it back from the moon?" And so they came up with a contingency plan to have pre-filmed footage to show everyone who's watching at home the moon landing, just in case that happened. And so they approached Stanley Kubrick to help them film that backup footage, which he then did, but they were under total secrecy about it. But Kubrick, being the subversive filmmaker artist that he was, started layering in movies after that where he could, hence that he was involved with Apollo 11 and the moon landing and stuff like that. Now, this footage that he shot was destroyed, and I don't think it's ever going to, you know, see the light of day. But it wasn't that he faked the moon landing. It was that he faked footage of the moon.
I think that's what they want you to
believe. In case they weren't able to actually broadcast it. But it is a fun conspiracy theory.
It's a great conspiracy theory. And that's the one thing I will give 100% credit to this movie for, is I love that theory. I love that it's weaved in throughout the whole thing. 237, the shirt, the whole everything. The motif, the carpet. Like, I agree. That's the coolest part of this movie for me. It's like, yeah, if he's going to be subliminal and weird and goofy Kubrick stuff, like, that's the way to go.
What's up with the bear suit?
so a freak.
So, no, in the book, it was a guy wearing a Halloween dog suit who was doing that.
Okay.
And Kubrick changed it for some reason. I don't know why. But what's really interesting...
Moon landing.
It reminds me of the suit from the Twilight Zone episode with William Shatner with the gremlin on the wing. Looks just like that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the adaptation, because Stephen King famously hates this movie.
Right.
And he doesn't feel like it represents like the book or anything
but
like that.
But if we hadn't gotten Stephen King's hatred for this movie, we would have never gotten Maximum Overdrive.
That soundtrack rocked.
it shook me all night long.
Dirty Deeds.
Still upset with you guys.
Cheap. Why?
Because I wasn't here to watch that movie.
You weren't?
No, it was,
no, it was with Tom.
Oh. We could do it again.
No.
Continue.
Well, I just think it's interesting that it's funny because I'm not a big fan of Stephen King or his writing. But Stanley Kubrick, when he was looking for his next project after Barry Lyndon, he was reading a bunch of books, and the unpublished manuscript of The Shining came across his desk. And his assistant talks about how, like, every time he'd read a book he hated, he'd throw it at the wall, and his assistant could hear like the thunk. And when he got to The Shining, he didn't hear the thunk. And he was like, oh, you must be liking it.
We got one!
Yeah, exactly. But Kubrick actually didn't like the book. Like he thought that Stephen King's writing was really bad, but he liked the ideas of it. And so what he wanted to do was he wanted to take the ideas that intrigued him and then put his own spin on it. And I'm usually very big on following the source material. I'm like, if you're going to adapt something, do a faithful adaptation. But those rules don't apply to artists like Stanley Kubrick, because I feel like Kubrick actually elevated the source material to a level that was beyond what was already in the book.
I'm excited to listen to the book and see the comparison.
Yeah, but there are a lot of very big differences in the between the book and the movie. Like you said, like Wendy in the book is kind of like an ex-cheerleader, and she's just kind of like, she's a little bit more, she has a little bit more agency. With Shelley Duvall, like Kubrick really wanted this feeling of dread and the spiral of helplessness. And so like he cast a woman that he knew had vulnerabilities, and then he ordered the entire cast and crew to treat her like shit so that basically her life would be a living hell, and she would better be able to express these feelings of hopelessness and fear and anxiety to the point where she would have panic attacks on set, her hair would be falling out, stuff like that. And then after it happened, it's just kind of like she understood why he did it, and she didn't like it when it was happening, but like looking back on it, she's like, okay, like it was one of my best performances that he was able to.
And the difference between what she looks like in the movie and what she looks like being interviewed like much longer after the movie, she looks so nice after. Like she looks like a panic attack during this movie.
She does.
Yeah.
She really does.
I feel like it's more of an excuse just to be a douchebag to somebody. I don't agree that that's, oh, that's artistry. No,
you don't get to abuse people for art. Sorry.
But there was this, there were these big differences. Like for instance, instead of a hedge maze in the books, it's hedge animals. So the animals would come to life and start stalking people. Instead of an axe that Jack would go around wielding, it would be a croquet mallet.
Hmm.
The Overlook Hotel explodes at the end of the book because Jack didn't didn't do his job with the boilers and they overheated and blew up.
Oh, that was another thing I loved.
Oh, she does all the work.
Is that she's doing, he goes to this interview to get hired for this job and he never does the job.
I don't think
she's doing it.
She's doing, all the work.
She does all the work.
Yeah.
She does the boilers, she does the kitchen, she does everything. Jack just sits there and fucks off.
Tells her not to fucking come in and then
he sleeps till 11:30.
Yeah.
Well, what's funny is that if you really pay attention to the movie, Jack has a very hard time sleeping. So like as the movie goes along, he's getting less and less sleep. And one of the cool things about this movie is that what Stanley Kubrick wanted to do was he wanted to make the audience believe that, okay, this is all in Jack's head up until a point. And then he does something where Jack's stuck in the food locker and he can't get out because Wendy locked him in there. Mm-hmm. And then he hears the voice of the previous caretaker who's advising him on how to kill his family. And basically at that point, the door unlocks. And that's the only thing that can't be justified by going crazy in the movie. And so just by adding that one element to the film, Kubrick created this big debate on like, okay, did the ghost actually free Jack to do that? Is there actual supernatural stuff going on? And one of the cool things is that there was originally a different ending to this movie that actually made it into theaters for like the first weekend before Kubrick said like, no, we have to take this ending out. And it all evidence of it has been destroyed except maybe like some stills and like an original shooting script or whatever. But what happened was he had shot an ending where after Jack is frozen to death in the hedge maze, we cut to a scene at the hospital where, Wendy is in the hospital and Danny's there. And the police show up to kind of like get their statements about what happened. And the head police guy who we saw on the radio a little bit earlier in the movie talking to Wendy gives Danny the ball that had rolled out of room 237 and then he leaves. And so the idea was that, the ghosts were real, like all this stuff actually happened. But Kubrick, for whatever reason, he was like, I want it to end on Jack's death and then cut to, the close-up of the picture frame. So he actually had all the prints pulled from the theaters, had that scene removed and then re-released. And only Kubrick had the kind of power and pull to do that type of thing for a movie.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think we ended up with a better ending.
Well, so my interpretation of it, and this is just how I view the movie as a consumer and just watching it, I like the idea that Jack became possessed by the previous caretaker. The ghost of the previous caretaker was there in the building and the haunting of his family was stuck in that building because of the supernatural elements that were introduced early with the Indian graveyard and stuff like that. And slowly he becomes to morph more and more into that other caretaker. And then he goes and tries to do the same thing he did to the first family as he tries to kill the family. And that's the thing. He gets possessed. And then he folds in as when he dies, he ends up becoming part of that haunting of the whole place.
And it gives you this creepy feeling of this didn't start with Grady.
No, it was probably before him.
Yeah. So the same thing happened to Grady. And then Jack being in the picture at the end makes you feel like, was he
always
there?
Was Grady the same guy?
Yeah. And it leaves you with a much more ambiguous and creepy feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the mark of a true classic film is it's something that sticks with you and you can debate and talk about, long after you've seen the movie. One thing I also want to point out is that, so Kubrick was always on the cutting edge of technology. And in this movie, 1980, he was utilizing video feedback, like video playback for, because it used to be like you had to wait for the dailies to come in to watch them. And now he was able to see exactly what they had just shot on video screens. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing, the biggest innovation with this movie was that it was the first time Steadicam was actually used in a movie. So like the guy who invented the Steadicam had just invented it, and Kubrick wanted these big, long, free-roaming tracking shots to really make the hotel feel like a character. And when he heard about this technology, he was like, I want to use this. And so like he flew out the guy who invented the Steadicam to be his Steadicam operator. And this is like the first movie to ever make real use of the Steadicam. And in fact, the guy was supposed to be there for like three months, I think. And he was like, I got other gigs that I have to get to, so I can only do it for 3 months. And so Kubrick, of course, like ended up shooting for close to a year. And so like Kubrick was like, well, I'll allow you to go do your other films, but you have to come back here every week. Hmm. And so like the guy would fly intercontinental from London, where they were shooting The Shining, back to LA, do like a week long gig, and then have to fly back and do like a week on The Shining. And it was just like, it was very rough, but like that was Kubrick, right? Like he just, he expected the best from everyone. And it's funny because in one of the documentaries that his daughter made of the behind the scenes stuff, you could see Kubrick at a typewriter. And what he's doing is he's actually typing out the pages, all work and no play, make Jack a dull boy. Because like you have that scene where like when he discovers the manuscript. And while he was shooting, when he couldn't do it, he had his assistant typing out those pages because he wanted 300 pages of all that stuff formatted in a manuscript. But in addition to that, they also, for like the foreign releases, they had to write those in like Italian, German, Spanish, like all this stuff. So like that's how kind of focused he was. So like depending on what country you saw the movie in, you would see a different manuscript.
You know, that would be a cool something to get a hold of.
To put a plaque on it. Yeah. Like here's the 300 pages.
No, just a sheet of it.
Yeah.
Just, you know, a framed piece of the manuscript.
I can make one of those for you.
But see, that's where I kind of disagree with, like, oh, this is artistry. Look how focused he was. Like, bro, you could do three pages.
Yeah.
And the rest of it could just be blank.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's not going to change.
It's just CG that
it's
now.
It's not going to change anything about the movie except for you tortured some poor person to write 300 pages of this thing for no reason but your own ego.
Yeah.
I don't like that idea.
It's like, I can appreciate Kubrick for his, you know, innovative use of the Steadicam, you know, following the kid around and the big wheel and stuff and making the hotel feel like it's its own character. Cause he did.
Sure. Yeah. Well. Yeah. It succeeded with that.
But man, I can't get over it just feels like a pretentious bullshit movie when I watch it. And you know, and that's just the plebe in me. I'm sorry. I'm just a guy who I don't like.
You like to be entertained.
I don't like arty films.
Yeah.
You know, this movie was a 2.5 hour long Stanley Kubrick art film.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't scary. It was a little freaky. There were some moments. That old lady, minus a star. Minus a star for old full frontal old lady. Gross. I don't want to see that.
Do we ever figure, is that the wife of the caretaker? Did he drown her in the bathtub? Is that how he killed her?
So, the hot one or the old lady one?
Both.
Yeah.
It's the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a scene where Grady is leading Jack into the bathroom after he spills that drink on him. And you can see there's a couple there, and there's like this woman in like this flapper outfit for like the New Year's celebration. And she's speaking to a younger man. And in the books, the woman in the bathtub killed herself because her younger lover jilted her. And so like the representation of the old lady is like how she felt compared to like her lover. Hmm. And so she's constantly trapped in that thing. But in Kubrick's film, like he just basically used the same actress as like the flapper girl as Jack's going into the bathroom. And you don't even recognize her because she doesn't look anything like, you know, the ghost. But like there's little things like that where like when you've watched this film 1,000 times at a quarter speed, like you're like, oh, okay, that's the ghost.
Have you watched this movie at quarter speed?
I have not.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm not that dedicated.
But that's the thing. I was like, that. Okay, so he reused the same actor for 2 scenes.
Yeah, big deal.
People do that all the time. And then they'll go, oh my God, it's artistry. No, it's you use the same actor for 2 scenes, dickhead.
Well, like, it's not that they use the same actor. It's that he made a connection to who the ghost was in room 237.
Yeah. Did they though? Because they didn't say it in the movie.
I never got that.
Yeah, they don't. I assumed it was the caretaker's wife that he drowned in the bathtub before he went and killed his daughters.
And that's the beauty of this movie is you can debate this stuff.
That's not a beauty. That's just a what if.
I don't know why you're so bad at
it. It just doesn't fucking make any sense. It's like things that in other movies are like, oh, that's an interesting coincidence. Well, but because it's Kubrick. No, he did it on purpose.
Well, yeah, because everything that made it on screen in a Kubrick film is meant to be there. Like, let me ask you this, right? Mm. So at the beginning of the movie, the guy who runs the Overlook Hotel who hires Jack, he talks about why they're not open for ski season, right? Why they're closer in the winter. And yet when Danny is in the game room and he sees the twins for the first time, there are actual posters on the walls about skiing. So why are there posters about skiing in a resort that's not open during the winter for skiing?
Because they need to feed the demon.
I don't know, dude. I don't know. Is there an answer?
Blood.
Is there an answer? Or was Kubrick just being artsy fartsy?
Well, the question is, was Danny seeing that stuff that wasn't actually there, just like the twins weren't?
Maybe it used to be open to skiing, and then they stopped because people kept dying.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said that, you know, like it was built before people could actually ski.
Yeah, that's true.
And then like the road would be snowed in, so like they couldn't be open during the winter.
But that's what I mean. Like, yeah, that's okay. So let's go down this thought path. But at the same time, it's like, does it fucking matter?
No.
Does it have any relevance whatsoever to the movie itself? No, not really. So I just, to me, it's just like, it's just a, it's pretentious. That's all it is.
You could open one of those windows and just ski down the side of the building.
People put Kubrick on this pedestal, and then like when they see shit in movies, they're like, oh my God.
So I'm going to push back on the pretentious thing a little bit, and here's my reasoning behind it.
Okay.
Okay. So when you're pretentious, what you're doing is you're making it very clear to the audience that you're being pretentious, right? Like, mm-hmm. like I'm so much smarter. Here's my symbolism. Like, it's Zack Snyder bullshit.
So
you'll see stuff on screen that's very obvious because like people, like the pretentious filmmaker wants people to notice it. Kubrick doesn't care if you notice it or not. He notices it. And it's his decision to put stuff in his movie, like the TV that is playing Class of 1942, another mm-hmm. 42 reference, mm-hmm. that's not plugged into anything.
Yeah.
Like, most people wouldn't notice. It's like, where's the plug for that movie or for that TV?
Yeah.
But Kubrick is like, he made a decision not to have the TV plugged in and yet working. And so you're like, well, why did he do that? But he never pulls attention to the stuff. The thing that I just told you about, the ski poster.
Yeah.
It's not something that is very obvious when you're watching that scene. But if you pay attention and you spot that and you ask the question, why is that? Thinking about the answer to that is not pretentiousness. It's basically the filmmaker has layered in a bunch of different stuff into his movie. And if you notice it, you wonder why he did it. And so like that's the difference between a pretentious filmmaker and an artist, is that the artist doesn't care if you notice it or not, whereas the pretentious filmmaker wants you to notice it because it makes him look smarter.
But if there is no answer and there is no relevance to it in the movie at all, then why? Just because, oh, I'm going to distract my viewers. If they notice Kubrick. It, if they notice it, they're going to question it. Well, but there's no answer. Well, I'm just going to fuck with their head.
But it's like the point is to try to decipher why the filmmaker made the decision. It's not necessarily that there is a concrete answer. It's like, what do you think the answer is behind the reason why the filmmaker did it? So it's not the fact that like, oh, like it's so ambiguous, you know, like, you know, you have to appreciate my genius. It's like, okay, Kubrick made a decision to do this. What was his reasoning behind that decision? And that's where the debates among film fans come from.
I think it's funny that you're using your Donald Trump voice for Kubrick, though.
What?
It's the best movie
ever. It's the best movie ever. It's the greatest thing ever. Okay.
It's so about the Holocaust. Needed,
we've been talking about this movie for half the length of the actual movie.
I needed dinosaurs, giant robots.
Okay. So this is obviously, this is not my cup of tea. I do appreciate it for what it is. I do appreciate it for its cultural relevance. I don't want to say it's not a bad movie. It's very well done. The acting is on point. Jack Nicholson just kills it in this movie. It's unsettling. I wouldn't say it's scary, but it's unsettling. And I can appreciate that as well.
There was a different standard for scary back in the
70s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the 70s. Yeah, the 70s had it because movies weren't like jump scare scary back then. It was all a little different. Even The Exorcist, which we all joke, it's not really scary anymore. But back in the day, it was terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
People were horrified at that movie.
I wouldn't watch that movie until I was like late 20s.
You just watched it. Didn't you just watch it?
Yeah, but that's because I was brainwashed.
Into thinking it was terrible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was brainwashed into thinking I was going to go to H-E Double Toothpicks if I watched that movie.
H-E Double Toothpicks. Wow. from my personal scale, on this movie, for an entertainment level and just for the Kubrick nonsense, I do love the moon landing stuff. That is right up my alley. I don't even think that's that subtle. I think that was pretty obvious in the movie. Like, hey guys, here's a rocket ship. Here's 2-5, you know, whatever the number is, 237.
NASA was real pissed when they saw this movie.
I wouldn't say that it was subtle in this movie. Like, oh my God, he layered these things in that nobody's going
to
notice.
In the book, it was room 217, and everyone always wondered, why did he change it to 237?
Because it's the moon landing. It's 237 miles away. 1,000. Where is it? Oh God, I think I have to just go middle of the road. I think it's like a 2.5 star. What's that like? That's like decent. That's like 60%, something along those lines. I don't know, but it's just not my cup of tea, man. I don't watch this movie unless I'm told I have to for some reason, or if somebody else is like, you want to watch The Shining? I'm like, I'll watch scenes of The Shining. Like, I'll watch the Jack scenes and I'll watch this and, you know, the good parts that are actually pretty cool. I cherry pick the shit out of this movie. The rest of it is boring.
And I think most of my exposure to this movie has been cherry pick scenes. I sat in that movie, or I sat and watched this movie last night And I told Def in the chat that this, I said, I don't think I've ever seen this whole movie. I've seen parts of this movie.
Yeah, get the cherry pick movie.
But
yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen the actual whole movie. I've sat down and watched it from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people have probably done this.
You know,
same
one
thing.
Of the most iconic shots of this movie is like the elevators of blood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was interesting because it would take 9 days to set up that shot. And then Kubrick didn't like the first two takes. And so like they kept doing it. They did it 3 times before they got it right. But each time they did it, it would take 9 days to like set that up and clean it up and reset. And the MPAA, back when they were, you know, were a lot stricter, they wouldn't allow blood in a trailer. And the Shining trailer opens with that shot. And so they were like, oh, that's way too much blood. You can't show this trailer. And Kubrick's like, well, actually, it's just rusty water from an elevator shaft. It's not actually blood. Yeah. And
they bought that?
Yeah, they did, because it's Kubrick. Kubrick is like, hey, trust me, it's just rusty water.
Oh, my God.
It's just the rustiest water that's ever happened in an elevator shaft.
The whole thing, you know, my whole life, you know, you see clips of this film and shots and stuff, and it's the hallways full of blood, and it's the two girls in the hallway.
And it's Jack getting the whiskey. You know,
the Ready Player One movie came out, right? There's more Shining shit in that movie than there is in this entire movie of the actual Shining.
That makes no sense. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
That's true. There's more Shining. There's more little twin girls and weird, creepy Shining shit.
And
in
like
that movie.
Easter eggs in that
and
movie.
And Easter eggs, and there is in this entire
that
movie.
That movie's just, it's just one big Easter egg.
Yeah.
It's literally about finding an Easter egg.
It's like the twin girls. I thought this movie, they were in the movie for less than 60 seconds.
Yeah, probably.
You know, it's just, so I was just
come
let
play
down.
With us, Danny.
It's like, I was like, okay, well, there are 2 or 3 scenes that they were in for 10 seconds each. Yeah.
What's your score?
I didn't enjoy this. I felt it was a pretentious pile of Stanley Kubrick crap, to be perfectly blunt.
All right.
2 stars.
Whoa.
2 stars, yeah.
Okay.
I might have given it 2.5, but the old lady grossed me out, so it's a negative half a star for that.
Was it counteracted by Scatman Crothers' wall art?
Oh, dude, that guy's living room was dope.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. Really quick, and I know we've talked about this a long time. We haven't talked about that kid at all.
Danny?
He's the one that he's like a psychic, right? He has special powers.
He's got the shining. Shine.
He's got the shining, right? Yeah. And we never, what is the shining? What is that exactly? Don't explain this to me. He's got psychic powers that he can
mentally
communicate with other people. He's a mutant. Is that what he is?
Well,
he can see the dead. He sees dead people.
When he's having ice cream with Scatman Crothers, they kind of lay out what it is, and they talk about how, you know, people don't just shine. Sometimes places shine too, and you can see, you know, like snapshots or photographs, like what happened there or what will happen. So like they do take time to kind of lay out the ground rules of like what Danny is and what he's experiencing. And it's kind of funny because like when the character of that Scatman Crothers plays like first meets Danny and he calls him Doc. And then in the sequel, Dr. Sleep, it's like, oh, Doc became a doctor. It's short for doctor.
Which I haven't seen. Have you guys watched it?
I've seen it.
Is it decent? Did it live up?
No, I didn't personally like it. The third act takes place at the Overlook Hotel again, and that part was really cool, but everything leading up to it, I was just kind of like, didn't like.
And I don't think that happened in the book. I know I read the book, but it's been a long time. I remember really liking the book, though.
But Mike Flanagan was the one who adapted the book to, you know, cinema, and he's the one famous for doing like, you know, The Haunting of Bly Manor and The Haunting of Hill House and stuff like that.
And
he's a big Stephen King aficionado, and he really tries to stick close to Stephen King stuff.
And in Dr. Sleep, they get more into what The Shining is because there's more people who have it, and then there's this group of predators who want it.
They're like energy vampires.
Yeah, it's different for everybody who has it, though.
If you want to talk about that movie and conspiracy theory with adrenochrome and Hollywood and all that stuff, that's some layering. Like, hey, over here. Okay, so Jude, what's your take on this movie? What's your score?
I love this movie. You know my stance on movies that are over 2 hours.
Yeah.
I hate them, and this has never felt like a too long movie to me. This doesn't feel like a movie that's longer than 2 hours because I'm watching every single scene and enjoying it. I love this movie. I love Jack Nicholson in this movie. I love all of the performances in this movie. Is it super scary? No. No, it's not. But it probably was in 1980. yeah, this is a good October watch.
Sure.
And it's a movie that has gone down in history. Like, this is a movie that people are going to still be watching 20 years from now.
I can't deny that.
No.
I can't.
It's not one of my favorite movies. It's not a movie I'm ever going to watch at half speed or 25% or whatever. But yeah, I would definitely watch this movie again. This is like a 4-star spooky movie for me. This okay. I'd give it 4. I'm not going to hurt you, Wendy's.
Just going to bash your brains in.
Just going to bash right the fucking tables
all over the place.
It's fun when the tables.
The comments split. Are going to come for us.
Oh, we're going to go out. Yeah, just don't even read the comments, bro. You and I are
fat fuck, fat bastard.
You and I are not going to be on the side of history on this one. That's all right.
Fatty McTubby dude, he doesn't know anything.
Doesn't know art.
He doesn't appreciate
art. In the okay, guys. World. It's totally
yeah.
art.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm doing Trump thing. Kanish, yeah, score is it 5 out of 5?
Yes, this is a 5-star movie. This is a masterpiece of cinema. This is Stanley Kubrick's crowning achievement throughout his filmography, and he's had a lot of like. Very influential and culturally relevant films. But out of his entire filmography, this is the one that everyone on the planet has seen and has recognized and can reference. And as a film student, like when you sit down and you watch this movie, it's like looking at the Mona Lisa for the first time. It's such a perfect piece of art that as a student of cinema, you digest this movie and you try to learn as much as you can from it because it truly is, it's not just a movie, it's a work of art. And it's something that you can watch a million times and find a million different things and have a million different conflicting opinions about and debate with other film geeks and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And so on its surface as like just a straight up horror movie, I totally get where you guys are coming from. Like it's, especially like, you know, as time goes on, it's not as groundbreaking as it once was. But at the same time, like if you dive deeper into it, and it does allow you to dive super deep, you can find very interesting like thematic elements. You can find very interesting filming techniques and stuff like that. And all that goes towards learning about the language of cinema because Kubrick was a master at that. And the more you're able to learn about that and his techniques and how he's able to not only make a movie, but structure a movie and stuff like that, the better you become at telling your own stories and making your own films and things of that nature. And it's very rare to have an auteur like Stanley Kubrick come along. In fact, I don't think there's ever been someone who's come along since he passed away that even comes close to his skill as a storyteller and a filmmaker.
Leave it on Zack Snyder, man.
Also, like as someone who loves Stephen King, and who lives with someone who can't stand Stephen King, this is the one movie that we can come together on.
Well, this is the only Stephen King adaptation, in my opinion, that's actually been good. Mm-hmm. Basically, like the book, I tried reading the book a long time ago when I was in film school because, you know, I wanted to see how the book compared to the movie. I got a couple of chapters and I was like, this book is garbage. and it's funny because watching the documentaries about Stanley Kubrick, he agreed with me. He was like, the book's garbage. Stephen King's not a good writer, but I like the themes. And so like he basically took the themes from the book that he liked and then spun a wonderful adaptation out of it that is far superior to
the
book.
We're going to see Kadish in a Kubrick Gets Me shirt next week, I bet.
I wish Kubrick got me. It was funny because watching the documentary that his daughter made of the making of this movie, it's very rare to get to see like Kubrick actually on set doing his thing. And it reminded me a lot of James Cameron on set doing his thing whenever I've seen like behind the scenes stuff of Cameron and how he like runs his crew and runs his set and stuff like that. Kubrick had, the production of this was actually kind of a mess because they would like rewrite the script as they went along. But Kubrick shot this in chronological order. And so like he kind of knew, okay, this stuff needs to evolve as we're shooting it in order to tell the story I want to tell. And so even though it was chaotic to the point where Jack Nicholson wouldn't even read the script until like the day that he was set to shoot because he knew that it'd be changing constantly. Up until that point, Kubrick had a vision and like he would adjust his vision, but at the same time, like he knew exactly what he wanted to do. And it is fascinating to watch these documentaries
where you actually get to see him like piss on Shelley Duvall.
Oh, come on. What do you mean roll video? We're killing ourselves out here and you're going to be ready.
I am too. I'm standing right by the door. Should we play mood music?
Like just make her feel like shit and then turn around and play chess with like the little boy or something like that. Like it was amazing to get to see this.
Cuckoo.
Yeah. I don't see that as a point of pride for anybody. He's just being a douchebag to a poor actress.
Just FYI, we're about to get married. Don't do this shit.
Well, listen, if I really want...
I will come at you with an axe or a croquet mallet.
I'm just going to say Hitchcock, who was kind of the precursor of artistry and filmmaking to Kubrick, he treated his actors the same way.
Yeah.
Like, he would do things to his actors to get the performances he wanted, and it was not always nice.
He would stalk his actors outside of work also.
And Cameron's been accused of the same thing, like the way he treated Kate Winslet on Titanic. Yeah. You know? So, like, there is method to the madness. It's not always a tactic that you agree with, but you can't argue with the results.
Yeah, find a better way.
Yeah, find a better way. Okay, well, hey, man, that's what you get with the Salty Nerd podcast. We go from pretentious trash to, like, looking at the Mona Lisa for the first time.
Ooh. Which is really small and tiny.
Don't make fun of him. He gets to have an opinion.
I've seen pictures of it.
Oh, well, everybody's fucking seen
it. And I've seen my daughter said, she's seen it.
Okay.
She says it's just really small. People put, you know, gravy on it with super glue. Save the planet.
Let me ruin this five. Yeah, anyway. All right. That was an interesting conversation. It was a lot of fun.
But exactly how I thought it was going to go.
Yeah, table split. Yeah.
This episode was fueled by Shady Mile.
Yeah, Shady Mile, not a sponsor. Not really. I can't drink because I'm on some medication, so
I had one
unfortunately.
Shot. I'm just not in the mood to drink.
We had some drinks while we were watching it.
Oh, yeah. I had some rum chata. Yeah. Homemade rum chata. Good. All right, we're out of here. Weird. Thank you guys for watching. Really appreciate it. What do you think of Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, quote unquote, The Shining? Comment below. Do you call us names? Call them names?
Don't call me names.
Don't call her names, though. Don't do that. I'll come after you. All right.
Fatty McTellator.
I don't want anybody to call me names.
All right, guys. We're out of here. Thanks so much for watching. Really appreciate it. Have a great time. Don't forget to check out Critiqlist for our reviews of this movie and many other movies. It's a fantastic new app that we're partnering up with for the month of October, for spooky month. And we highly suggest go checking it out. It's very addictive, very fun, and it's a great community. You're on the ground level. It's a brand new app, so if you get in there, you can go and review your favorite movies, be the first one out there, and get your reviews in there.
And we're talking about Alien next week. So why don't you go out there and put your review on Critiqlist before we can get to it.
Masterpiece.
Finally, get something good to watch.
Oh, 5 out of 5. I'm giving it away right now. All right, we're out of here, guys. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week. Stay salty.